Welcome back to Distillery Sessions. This is episode 6, where today Peter Hoffer is going to be chatting with direct-to-fan marketeer Jesse Schooler.
My name is Peter Hoffer, and I will be your host for today's Distillery Session. Now, today I am joined by Jesse Schooler, and we will be talking about music and fandom. Now, Jesse is the owner of Wicksteed Works, a London-based agency empowering artists and brands to maximize their potential through connection, communication, coordination of kick-ass direct-to-fan marketing and retail campaigns. Now, with a focus on email and e-commerce, Wicksteed Works clients have included few famous names like Laura Marling, Mumford & Sons, Elvis Costello, Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds, Neil Finn, Little Boots, and Paul McCartney. Now, Jesse has published several industry guides, including membership, fan clubs, and monetization in 2020, and the first comprehensive comparison of direct-to-fan music, marketing, and retail services. Now, Jesse has cut her teeth in the world of direct-to-fan in the fast-paced environment of Topspin Media's creative services team. And before leaving her native New Zealand way back in 2007, she's worked in CRS management and practiced as a commercial solicitor. So, Jesse, welcome to our podcast.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Now, that is quite the leap from solicitor to music. That's not an everyday journey. So how did you come about making that big leap?
Yeah, it's definitely been a roundabout sort of a pathway. I worked in the music industry for more than 15 years now, but I never had any formal education in music business or in marketing, even though I find myself teaching both of those things now. So it has been a bit odd. I actually studied law, as you mentioned, and politics, philosophy, and economics at university. And when I came out, I hadn't really thought too much about what I was going to do next, that tending to be my approach in life. But I thought perhaps if I could put two and two together and try and be a music lawyer, because I was quite into music. I worked on the student radio, editor of the student newspaper, and I found myself with a law degree. So perhaps I could be a music lawyer, I thought, and that kind of led to me becoming a very accomplished photocopier in the basement of a big law firm, and I worked there for rather longer than I ought to have. But eventually I did land a job in a small practice where I did fairly dull things like conveyancing, wills and trusts, drafting terms of trade. But during this time I started managing a friend's band, and they had never had a manager and I had never been a manager. So we were kind of perfect for each other, and we pretty much made it up as we went along. And having this band's interests to look after really gave me an agenda in the music industry. And coming from New Zealand, the music industry is, well, we all know New Zealand is very small. The music industry is particularly small. And being somewhat bold and resourceful, it was fairly easy to meet people once I had this agenda of the band's interests to push. So I managed them for around a year before we parted ways. And just to put this into context, this was back in about 2004. So my first social network was called Friendster. Not sure if anyone who's listening will know about Friendster, but it was certainly the place to be for a short time. And I guess just to give some more context of where I was at, I was very interested in computers all of my life, but it wasn't until this point that I actually owned one or had one in my home. Mm-hmm. Now that I was earning money, I was able to buy myself a computer. So I got involved in the internet. I wrote a blog. I was quite active in some online music communities. But in the bigger picture, I really wasn't interested in my career as a commercial solicitor. And what I wanted to do was to move to London.
Okay.
I wasn't quite ready to move to London yet. So I moved from Wellington up to Auckland, which is the biggest city in New Zealand and where most of the music industry is based. And through chance, very shortly after arriving in Auckland, I met the CEO of the Recording Industry Association, which is a trade group that represents the major labels and big labels in New Zealand. And he was very well connected. He ran a big management company alongside his role at the Recording Industry Association, and he also promoted a big festival. Long story short, I became his PA. I stepped aside from the law, the legal biz, and I became a PA. And I got to work on a load of things, which were a lot of fun. I got to manage artists' business affairs on a day-to-day basis. I was stage managing and tour managing live shows and going around the country with bands. I was dreaming up sourcing and selling merchandise, which was one of my favorite parts of the job. And I also had a finger in public performance licensing, because that was another thing that was very small industry. You wind up doing a lot of things that don't necessarily seem to go together. So, I was doing lots of different things, and I really loved that job. It showed me a lot of great times, and I learned a lot about lots of different parts of the industry. And after a couple of years, I'd saved up enough money, and I moved over to London. And when I got here, I started working for PRS, so the company, the collection society that looks after copyrights in musical works on behalf of songwriters and publishers. And it was a fairly uninteresting role to talk about, but I was there for a couple of years, and it gave me a good grounding in the UK industry and allowed me to meet a lot of people. And then I actually had a redundancy after that time, and I didn't really know what to do next. I had a little bit of time to figure it out. I knew that I wanted to stay in the music industry, but I wasn't really very interested in licensing. And yeah. I quite liked the management experience had been good to me, but I was also still feeling like I didn't really want the responsibility of managing my own artists.
Yes.
So what I decided was that I wanted to work with lots of different artists in more of a project management type basis. So this is when I heard about a company called Topspin. This is back in 2009.
Okay.
And they were what's called a direct-to-fan platform, I suppose, direct-to-fan marketing and retail platform. So they provided software that allowed anyone who was a band to create an account, to build a mailing list, to create products and to sell products and to manage all of that under one platform. So that was the start of where I am now, really. I worked there in the London office. I actually started out as an intern at age 30 as an intern. That was quite cool. What is direct fan strategy? What does it mean to consider the fans kind of the key part of the music industry, and to make sure that you're building a strong relationship between the artist and the fan, and giving them the opportunity to buy things that they want to buy? And from there, after a couple of years, Topspin, the company that I was working for, actually supported me to set up Wicksteve Works as a partner agency. So they were actually, they were more focused on building the software, and they wanted partners like me to be servicing that software and looking after it on behalf of artists. So people like Paul McCartney and Noel Gallagher would hire me to run, to build their projects using the software, and then and everyone would be happy. So okay. That was great, and that worked out really well for a couple of years. I had a pipeline of projects that were just being fed to me. And then in about 2013, the Topspin platform was sold to a little company called Beats, and then Beats was sold to a little company called Apple, and that kind of meant that all my relationships sort of disappeared overnight, and the pipeline went dry. And I didn't realize until that moment how good I'd had it in terms of having all those amazing clients given to me on a plate. So I really had to figure out what to do next at that point. And that was what led me to start to research the market in the music space of what other software was out there besides the one that I'd been working with. What else were artists using to sell and to build their fan bases and to create e-commerce stores? So that was what led to the production of this industry first report, Which Platform. It was called Which Platform, which I thought was very obvious when I wrote it. It didn't really occur to me that anything online is a platform. And also, a lot of people say Which Platform when they're at a train station trying to figure out where they're supposed to be. You're even at Clapham Junction wondering where on earth you ought to be. So anyway, we got through that. But yeah, doing this research and launching it into the world back in 2014 was a real game changer for me, in that it showed me what else was out there. But it also showed the industry who I was, because I produced a report, I published it, I got quite a lot of coverage. And from then on, really, I've been asked to speak at a lot of conferences and talk about what it is that I'm passionate about, which is this direct-to-fan strategy. And it's been amazing. It's opened a lot of doors, and that's kind of brought me to where I am today. And now I have to focus quite deeply on audience communication side and trying to be really smart and use great automated tools where possible for managing an audience and communicating with an audience, and being really clever about the way e-commerce is bundled into a campaign.
Yes. Excellent. That's quite the journey. So you mentioned a few times about merchandising and, you know, opportunities for, fans to purchase products from their favorite musicians. Now, I guess the stereotype of, you know, a band or an artist is to, you know, focus only on the music, that, you know, selling any items would be, you know, considered selling out. You know, what, you know, did you have those type of conversations with, you know, the artists you work with, and how did you sort of go about navigating their concerns when it comes to merchandising or providing those type of items for fans?
Yeah, it's an interesting proposition. Some artists, or most artists, are fairly comfortable with the idea of the t-shirt, the tote bag, the kind of standard items of merchandise that you'll see at a live gig. We used to see when we used to go to live gigs. That's pretty standard. There's not usually an issue with those, but it's when we start talking about expanding that product range that sometimes you can run into some issues. It's certainly sometimes there is an attitude amongst artists where they might feel there's a conflict between the artistry and a commercial element that that we might want to bring to that for the business side of it. But it's a conversation to have with an artist about trying to explain that commerce is not a dirty word. And I'm definitely not saying this is the case with all artists. I'd say it's a fairly rare attitude, but it's really just a matter of kind of taking it, approaching it in a way that everyone's comfortable. So I mean, from where I'm standing as a fan of music and as a lover of music merchandise and owner of far too many band t-shirts and a growing collection of socks and hoodies and mugs and tea towels, you know, I think it's quite rare that we regard the merchandise that's on sale at a live gig as a sign that an artist is selling out or trying to rip us off. No one's forcing us to buy these things. And as long as they're good quality products, I think more often we think about the advantage of taking home this unique piece of the artist home with us, you know, after a show. It's a physical reminder of a great night out. It's something that we can take on as a part of our identity. We can display it in our homes. We can show it off to our friends. So I think that looking at it that way, it's more of an opportunity for a fan, and it's more of, I think it's more doing something nice for your fans by giving them that opportunity to take something home. And also I think a lot of artists are really smart in the way that they'll involve their fans in the process of creating merchandise, or ask them what they prefer in terms of, like, get them involved with even submitting their own designs that might artwork designs that might be used for merchandise. Or I think there's an artist, I think it's Bring Me the Horizon, hopefully I've got that right, they actually use photographs of their fans wearing their products to advertise them on their website. So fans will, you know, user generated content, the fans will submit photographs of them wearing the t-shirt, whatever it is, and that's what's used then to promote the item to other fans. So, you know, I think there's a way of making it work for everybody.
Yeah, no, that is quite clever. Again, bringing the fans into the conversation rather than just a one way the band speaking to their fans and not knowing, you know, what they're thinking, what their reactions are. So I guess you mentioned early on of, you know, emerging online platforms like Friendster, or, you know, I think we're familiar with the other early social networks like MySpace and that type. So how do you think technology has evolved a bit to better facilitate that conversation between fans and musicians?
It's almost a double-edged sword, I think. I guess on the positive side, we have so many ways to communicate now. I think in terms of being a fan of music, there's always been a desire as a fan to know more about our favorite artists and to see behind the curtain and to know what they're thinking and what they're feeling. And I mean, you know, there's a spectrum of this, obviously, but we're talking about real super fans. And that, you know, and also I think another part of being a fan is knowing that you're part of a community and being able to share information. And these things are really enabled by technology and by social networks and fans being able to mobilize. And we see these formal and informal networks of fans. The big ones we can think of are Lady Gaga's Little Monsters, yes. Beyonce's Beehive, there's the Beliebers, Directioners, there's these kind of like, you know, really strong networks of fans. And they're formidable, and they're a force in the industry, and they're something that needs to be respected because they have enormous buying power as well. But I guess thinking about the technology, while it enables fans to mobilize and it also enables us to collect and share information, it also, there's a danger that it leads to this always on society. And I think it's the same, you know, for music and off music. We need to have some common sense. And, you know, there's privacy to respect. There's also just like giving people space. So, yeah, I think it's, there's an expectation almost that artists are supposed to, or can, because they can be constantly communicating with fans, should they be. And as someone who's really interested in communication strategy and how different artists will approach this, I think it has to come down to the individual fan and what works, to the individual artist and what works for them and their fan base. So it's definitely about maintaining a balance. I don't think there's anything to be gained by constantly, as an artist, pushing out information, because we get fatigued by it. As a fan, sure, there needs to be a little bit of waiting and a little bit of intrigue. So, yeah, I think it all comes back to having a plan, really. If I'm an artist and I need to get some messaging out, then I need to be careful about how I'm going to drip that out and what's going to be the best way to tell the story and keep people engaged.
Sure. Yeah, I think, you know, as you mentioned, those super fans like the Bay Hive and Gaga's Monsters, I think I've noticed just in our vocabulary, we, instead of saying fans, we say stans now, which, you know, goes back to the Eminem song of that.
Okay.
That really passionate fan who sometimes goes maybe above and beyond just the admiration.
That's quite an extreme example. I'm not sure I would want to be called a stan. I think that's a little bit derogatory, but I can understand that is a word that is used now.
But I guess, those fans who are super passionate could have, well, I guess my question is, how do you sort of advise artists to maintain that healthy balance of listening to fans, but not letting them drive sort of, the artist's creative drive? So not letting them control what the artists do in order to keep the fans happy, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I hear. I mean, I think it comes down again to the individual artist. And one of the first conversations I usually have with artists is to talk to them about what's important to them, what they're passionate about, what are their values as an artist. So I often ask the question, which is kind of a sneaky one, really, but how would they describe themselves if they weren't allowed to make any reference to the music? Mm. And they're often quite stumped by that, because they're like, oh, I always identify myself with my music. But what I'm getting at with that is that when we have an artist whom we know a little bit more about, so we know that they're really passionate about the rainforests or surfing, sure, or baking or whatever, if we know a little bit more about them, then it adds to our picture of that artist, and it also gives that artist more things to have a conversation about. And I think that when we know a little bit more about an artist and they're willing to share a bit more of themselves, up to, it's always within the bounds of what they're comfortable with, it gives them more things to start conversations about, and it can give us as fans more things to engage with them about. So it can lead to a much more multi-dimensional relationship with fans. And I think this is really important for a good and strong communication strategy, because there are times when there isn't anything to talk about when it comes to music, you know.
Very true.
They're not always writing, they're not always creating, they might be having an off season or just some time out, or they've just released something so they're taking a break or whatever. But it's good to be able to keep brand awareness sounds a little bit cold, but it's good to be able to stay in fans' minds but have other things to talk about. So, sure. Yeah, I would never want artists to feel like they were beholden to fans to be obliged to create something. But to be able to have conversations about other things can be a really useful way of keeping that connection alive.
Yeah. No, I guess it makes them makes the artist seem a bit more human when you see them, you know, baking or gardening or just doing those type of things. It just makes them even more human and a stronger connection with their fans.
Yeah.
So we mentioned a few sort of examples of, you know, different ways that artists can be, you know, better connected with the fans. Can you think of, you know, who are the musicians that you think engage best with fans, and, you know, what are the lessons that emerging artists can learn from them?
Sure, sure. I mean, there's a lot of examples of artists that are really clever with the way that they think about how to engage with fans. And some that appeal to me. One that I often like to talk about because he's quite astoundingly inspirational is Nick Cave, and he has a mailing list that he started up in September 2018. So it's only been going for less than 2 years, and it's a sort of a subsidiary list from his band, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, main mailing list. So this is a subsidiary mailing list called the Red Hand Files, and he set this up. I think it was aligned with a series of events he was doing that were in conversation events. So he wasn't. It wasn't about him playing live. It was about him doing these kind of, not so much talk show, but more these sort of theatre shows where he would sit on the stage and he would take questions from the audience and he would just answer the questions. And he does so in a very poetic and thoughtful and insightful way. So alongside this, he launched the Red Hand Files. And this is a mailing list and a website where fans are invited to submit questions. And he has a lot of passionate fans all over the world, and they have a lot of burning questions for him. And he and he answers them very consistently. He sends an email out at least once a week. And the thing that got me was the first email that he sent out where he announced that he was going to be doing this new subscription. He used the line, "There will be no moderator. This will be between you and me." And for me, as someone who's really interested in director-fan, artist-fan relationships, that is such an encapsulation of what we're aiming for here. To make, I mean, it's obviously impossible to actually have that one-to-one relationship with an artist as a fan.
Yes.
But to be able to create a very effective illusion of it is something that's really masterful. And he writes these emails with such generosity, with such wisdom. Anyone who knows a thing or two about Nick Cave will know that he's had a pretty up and down life. He's had some really hard experiences. He has a certain black humor that he throws in now and then. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think it's incredible, and it does such a great job of building goodwill for him as and his brand. There's never really any commercial messaging overtly in these emails. He keeps those for his other mailing list or, you know, someone else to manage. But for him, it's just making himself available in a really generous way. And because I'm very focused on the email channel, another example I would use, another example or two, George Ezra is an artist who has a really lovely style when it comes to communicating with his fans. When I get an email from George, I feel like I'm getting a letter from a friend. He's so informal and engaging and kind of fun and quite insightful. I feel like I'm getting to know just enough of him to feel, you know, kind of heard and seen. And he also has some quite good tricks in that he will sometimes include interactive elements in his emails. Like he might have a poll in there that's open up until a certain time. So for the next few days, and if I engage with the poll, you know, the interactive element in the email will show that I've engaged with it. So it's quite a clever trick for encouraging people to open the emails. And as an email strategist, those kind of things always appeal to me as well.
Yeah, and I guess, again, it goes back to that, you know, the sign of a good relationship, that two-way relationship. It's not just a blanket newsletter out to everyone, but it seems, you know, George is quite keen to hear what you think, which, you know, makes the fans feel valued.
Absolutely.
Are there, we talked about earlier of, you know, merchandising, like the standard merchandising, the band t-shirt, things like that. Are there perhaps merchandise that really, you know, takes it up a level, or, you know, things that really wowed you when it comes to band merchandising?
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of my favorite things. And whenever I work with an artist on a release campaign, one of the first things I want to talk about with them in terms of the e-commerce side is, okay, so what are we going to offer? We got your album, sure, I know you've got your album, but what else can we add to that album to bulk it out? Because what's really important to have an effective e-commerce strategy is to have a range of price points. So you need to be having those low-level price points so that the kind of the fans who are a little bit more on the fence have something that will appeal to them, whether that's a, I don't know, a sticker or a patch or something that's not a big investment, kind of thinking about up to sort of £5 to £10 type price point. But then at the other end, depending on the artist, there's such a opportunity to throw in some options that are, I don't know, £75 or higher. And that might include something that's much more limited edition, handmade, exclusive, customized, whatever you like. Those kind of offers are really important to have on the table. Even if the artist only sells one or even none of these offers, having a high level price point on the page can do so much to set the context for the other offers, particularly if it's the first price point that we see. But yeah, don't let me get carried away with pricing strategy, because that's not what we're here for. In terms of those top level products, though, I've seen some pretty amazing ones lately. One of the most exceptional ones I saw came from Björk, who offered a really beautiful piece alongside her recent album Utopia.
Okay.
She created a let me read to you the official description.
Sure.
It's essentially a custom made box full of 14 handmade bird call flutes. That is correct.
Oh.
Bird call flutes. So let me read to you. It says it's a deluxe edition box set that comes housed in a bespoke Perspect case designed by a designer in Paris. The hand-etched lid features an intricate design, while tinted side panels cast a softly coloured glow, illuminating the 14 unique bird calls nestled inside individually assigned compartments. How about that? So this amazing, amazing box, which is a beautiful piece of art that's, you know, it's a kind of a vinyl record size box, and it's got these wooden handcrafted flutes. It includes a USB drive with the album itself and a bunch of extra content. It's got some beautiful full color booklet, and that whole thing was on sale for £500.
Mm.
So we're at the top end, really, in terms of merchandise. And I don't know how many she sold, but I know that for an artist like Björk, I'm sure there was a market for that, because
yes. They're
a fan. She's got a big fan base, and some of those fans are going to feel like owning that one-off amazing piece is absolutely worth £500. Or if it's not for me, it's something that I want to get for as a gift, because it's a status symbol. It's a beautiful thing to have on your coffee table and show off.
Yes, and it's totally the Björk brand to have an object like that. I remember going to there was a exhibition at the V&A before the lockdown, where it focused on the art of the kimono, and actually one section had Björk's kimono for a music video. I can't remember the name of the music video, but to see that standing alongside, you know, ancient Japanese kimonos, it just shows, you know, her building a brand that's strong enough to actually be in a museum sitting alongside other art. That's, again, I think just another sign of, you know, smart artists really being quite attentive to the image and brand she portrays.
Yeah, she's an artist for sure.
Say, if you're meeting an artist that is just, you know, they're just starting out and they have, say, £1,000 to really start building their brand, building their marketing, what would you advise they spend that £1,000 on?
Sure, that is a great question. So we've got an emerging artist, they have £1,000 to spend. What's going to be the most effective way to spend that on their career? For me, what's really important, assuming that they're fine with their music, and I'm going to leave the recording side alone, I'm just going to focus on kind of the marketing side of things. I think that the first thing that a band should be spending money on is their branding, the visual identity that they want to portray to the world. So I think that having a really good, strong visual logo, having a color palette that they can draw on, this is just key. This is where it needs to begin, because this is going to feed into so many things. They're going to need it for all of their online profiles, for social media, for gig listings. They're going to need to include it on their website, on their email headers, all throughout the subscription process. And they're also going to need it for their merchandise. You know, if they want to be creating merchandise, starting to build products, even just like record covers, so important to start with that strong visual identity. And I know that that's incredibly hard, because ideally they're going to choose a logo that they're going to stick with for a period, if not for their entire career.
Yeah.
Obviously, bands are allowed to change their logo, but if you think of an artist like Metallica, where their logo is so synonymous with the band, like, it's, you know, everyone knows that AC/DC, some of those big logos, we know the band, we know so much backstory as soon as we see that logo. So that is what I would spend the money on. I don't actually know how much it costs to get a logo, but that's certainly what I would put the bulk of that £1,000 towards, if not all of it.
No, that's really fascinating. I guess artists would immediately sort of think of doing a TikTok video or something that would go viral. So a single hit rather than, you know, what you mentioned of what is the long-term investment in your brand.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, there may be value in a TikTok video as well. It is not my specialty area, but I don't know if you would spend £1,000 on a TikTok video, if you would get the equivalent value back. I'm not really sure what the return on that investment would be. It could be some great goodwill. I don't know.
True. No, I guess it's thinking of yourself as like a company, of having a strong visual identity that would work across flyers, merchandise.
Exactly. I think it's a foundation piece for sure.
Excellent. Well, I think we are almost done with this episode, but I do have a couple questions, a bit Desert Island Disc style, just to get your thoughts on. So my first question is, what's the last thing that you recommended to a friend or a family member? You know, it could be like a Netflix show or a new recipe or anything like that.
Okay. I actually recommended a book to a friend recently. I'm a big fan of the author Daphne du Maurier.
Oh, yes.
I don't know if you know her. She's from Cornwall. She wrote a book called My Cousin Rachel, which was actually made into a film about, I don't know, 8 or so years ago. I haven't seen the film, but I read the book recently, and it really, really kind of turned me inside out. So I absolutely recommend that to anyone who's looking for a good read this summer.
Okay. Well, now that we have a bit more time on our hands, I think a book recommendation is a smart way to go. And finally, what are you a fan of that might surprise most people? So this could be something like, maybe you're a fan of professional wrestling or crocheting or something like that. What would surprise your family and friends?
You know what? I don't know if anything would surprise my family and friends. That's a tricky one. I'm a big fan of dogs, but I don't think that's very surprising. I like to make my own, what's it called? I've forgotten the name of it. Now that we're talking on air, kimchi. I love to make my own kimchi.
Do you have a special twist on what you put in it?
I do, actually. Kimchi is traditionally made with cabbage, and I'm a little bit lazy with cabbage because you have to brine it first, and for some reason I'm a little bit like confused by the brining process. So I don't use cabbage. I use the Japanese the Japanese radish, the daikon.
Daikon instead.
Yeah, that's my tip, which I still have to brine. So really, my argument is point. But I like to make a kimchi with daikon, which is actually called kakdugi. I'm absolutely pronouncing that wrong, but it's got a whole different name. It's a whole new world.
Excellent. All right. Well, so if people wanted to get in contact with you, whether it's related to the music industry or kimchi recipes, how is the best way for them to contact you?
The best way is probably via my website or any social profile. So the website of wickstedworks.com, that's wickstedworks.com, or you can find me at wickstedworks on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter.
All right. Well, thank you, Jesse, for joining me today. And I want to thank everyone else for listening to this podcast. Now, you could follow Distillery on our socials at We Are Distillery. And make sure to stay safe, wash your hands, and we look forward to welcoming you to our next podcast soon. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks again for joining us on Distillery Sessions. Don't forget to subscribe, rate the podcast, and leave us a comment wherever you pick up your podcast from.